Okay, this evening is a special evening. We get to listen to the junior Sangha members, or at least the non-Ajahns, the non-Ajahn members of the monastic community, give reflections, Dhamma reflections. And this is a hallowed tradition at Wat Nongpapong in Thailand after the Vasa on the Pavarana day. Actually, the Vasa that I spent at Wat Nongpapong, my seventh Vasa, there was 61 bhikkhus, so they had to spread it over 2 days. They had these all-night talks for 2 days in a row, so they could hear everybody's talk. And there was no real time limit. Some monks would give shorter talks, some longer talks. Here we could say about, 10 minutes or so is a good limit. 10 minutes. But we won't stop you if you're on a roll. But if you go longer than 30 minutes, I might ring the bell. But we'll see. So I will choose people at random. And whoever comes up, if you're new to this, then you can start by reciting the Namo Tassa three times. And then if you know the beginning of the Dhamma talk, Budong Dhammang Sangang Namasami, then you can do that. If not, that's fine. Since it is a new experience, just the Namo three times is also good enough. So, without further ado, random. Anagarika Michael.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
All right.
Did not expect this to be a random selection. But yeah, that was definitely a throw off. Something has been coming up. I didn't really plan what I was going to say or talk about. I felt like that would make it a little too rigid. But something that was coming up was this quality of patience, oton. My Anagarika ordination, Ajahn Nanako mentioned oton a little bit, and it's been kind of a theme in my life. I did a lot of long distance running when I was younger, and was kind of reflecting on that and how it related to the practice a little bit. At the beginning of a race, there's a lot of energy. Before the race, you're sort of under this tent, and you start in the early morning, so you're normally covered in the dew of the grass, and you're wet and uncomfortable, and you're sort of wearing very little clothing, so you're really cold as well, and you have all this anxiety for a big race, which takes a lot of your energy, and so nothing's really happening, but you're thinking quite a lot. Oh, in 20 minutes I have to do this race. It's going to be really painful. Right now I'm cold and shivering and thinking I don't want to eat anything because I don't want to be uncomfortable during the race. And then once you get to the starting line of the race, you're in line with maybe like 400 or 500 people. You're all kind of cramped together in this little line. And this is where everybody is packed in to the front. So the people racing and all the spectators. And so there's all this energy. And so they'll fire the gun and everyone starts running. You sort of have to figure out over a lot of races how you're going to start. Because of all that energy and thinking beforehand, you can tend to want to do all the race in the first 100 meters. And the race is a few miles. And so a lot of times you'll see these, it's in high school, so you'll have these freshmen that will, they'll like sprint before everybody. And they'll look behind them like, oh, like, I'm the first out of 500 people. Like, no one's going to catch up with me. And then eventually, as you run, you'll kind of see that guy come back. And you do this a couple times and realize, like, oh, it's actually better to start pretty slow. But you have a lot of momentum in the beginning because everyone you know is sort of yelling and it's really intense. And then, sort of similar at the end of the race, you're tired, but you'll see basically the same people waiting for you at this gate. And you'll normally have at least one or two people next to you, and there's sort of like this little final sprint. And you'll see people feed off that energy, and sometimes they'll even faint right at the very end. They'll use up everything, and it can be quite dangerous. you'll have all these people coming into a bottleneck, and some people are passing out and some people are sprinting, and it can get really crazy. But there's this period in the beginning of the race, and I'm from Alabama, and so all of our races will take place in the forest. And sometimes it had just rained and sometimes it was really dry, but you're just on this dirt path about this wide in the forest, and there's people around you with spikes on their shoes. And in the beginning, you basically just hear everyone screaming, but in the middle, there's this eerie silence that's with you in the race. It's so quiet that you can hear the people next to you breathing, and all you hear is kind of like the clacking of shoes on the ground and the people around you breathing. And so one of the things that I discovered racing was that essentially if I thought about the end of the race, I would slow down. I would see the people next to me get farther and farther in front of me. And so I had to learn to not think so much about what's about to happen at the end and just essentially race. And I think the reason what I've been reflecting on is why I thought so much in the races is basically just really painful to run for a long time next to people who basically act as a metric for how well you're doing. So you'll have to keep up with this one guy. You sort of can't take it easy. And when I was wanting to ordain as an Anagarika, and after I ordained, you want to call it ordination, taking on the training, kind of had to tap back into that mentality of,
I have to wake up every day at 4 a.m. and come to morning puja. We have to do that every day. And if you open your eyes in the morning and you're in your kuti and you hear the cicadas, sometimes you can't even get mad at the cicadas. Maybe you don't come up for a couple more hours and I can just get some sleep. And then I'm agitated, roll up my sleeping bag slower, put on my clothes slower, walk down the mountain slower. But then I remember, this is kind of like racing. Like, I can just not really think about it too much. There was one tea time where I was asking Ajahn Purunadamo a question and trying to compare myself to some like complicated idea that I heard in a sutta. And he basically just told me to stop thinking so much and just don't make everything so complex and try to make some big idea out of something, and instead just see how you're feeling right now. And so even Anagarika only being 1 year, it can seem pretty long, but every moment is just this moment. So it's not really long if it's just right now. Maybe this talk has been kind of long, but maybe it doesn't seem long if you've just been listening right now. But I thought this quality was really important in just not only getting through something that seems long, but dealing with uncomfortable things that come up and actually being able to be there for them. Because normally when I'm thinking and making something too complex, I'm just running away from the way I feel right now. So maybe this can be useful in reflecting on how you've been feeling, or maybe something you've been running away from, and that you can actually hang out with it for a little bit and get to know it. And enjoy being uncomfortable. That's all I have to say. Okay, thank you, Anakurka Michael. And next, Tantisaro.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Budang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. For those of you who don't know what Tudong is, it's a practice in this Thai forest tradition where the monks basically, we take our robes, a bowl, a little bit of gear, a glot, which is a umbrella with a mosquito net that goes on top, just string it up on a line, and that's what you sleep under, meditate under. So with minimal gear, a lot of times we'll just walk out of the monastery, but Tanhemiko and I got a ride. We were dropping somebody off at the airport. I think they were going down to SFO, but they dropped us off in Santa Rosa, and we just started walking out River Road to the west. So, tell you one story. I might tell you two.
I went way over time last time, so I'll try and I'm going to practice restraint and only go for 45 minutes. So day three, we're making our way into Guerneville, and I seemed a little depressed. It seemed like there was a good bit of homelessness in the town. No offense if anybody's from Guerneville. That was just my sort of immediate impression. It just felt a little sad. You know, a lot of security cameras around the Safeway and no loitering signs. And so we stood out kind of on the sidewalk outside of the Safeway parking lot. And we weren't there that long. We had a few interactions with people. One young couple, they tried to offer us money, and we sort of explained to them that we don't use money. And then they said, oh, well, we're going into the Safeway. And then he kind of stopped and he turned to me and he said, hey, what's the opposite of love? And I said, more love. I don't know why. This is a weird answer, but I was improvising. And he said, fear. So, okay, thanks. And he left. And then he came back later and he had bananas and he had said, have no fear. The bananas are here. And he offered us bananas. I didn't realize you were setting up a punchline then. So we had a few interactions with people, and then this older guy came up, and he was sort of scruffy, gray hair, gray beard, and he was just really bright eyed, just so happy to see us. And he just said, oh, do you guys accept food? And he had a bunch of canned goods, and we said, sure. And so he was offering us food, and he said, oh, I'm just so happy to see you. We need more religious people in the world, and the world is so dark. And oh, I'm just so happy to see you. And he offered us all this food, and he introduced himself, and we introduced ourselves, and we chanted him a blessing, and then he gave us a hug, which isn't that, you know, it's not that normal, but he was very enthusiastic and was happy to do it. And he left, and we had an interaction with another person, and then a little while, and then he comes up again, and he's got two big loaves of bread, and he puts a loaf in Hamiko's bowl and a loaf in my bowl, and he's just, oh, I'm just so happy to see you guys. It's so great to see you. And what was his name? Manny. And so we chanted him another blessing, and he left, and we stood there for a little while longer and had another interaction or two, and then guess who comes up again? Third time around, Manny shows up. He's like, I got you coffees. And so he brought us two coffees, and he brought a bunch of sort of the flavored creamers and a quart of whole milk. And so he offers us all this stuff. So we just got, you know, we've got this feast from Manny. And so we're like, okay, I guess we're set. We're set for the day. So actually he said, how long are you guys going to be here? I'll take care of you every day that you're here. And we said, well, you know, we're just kind of passing through town. So, you know, we chanted him another blessing, and he almost had tears in his eyes. He was just so happy. It was incredibly uplifting. And so we went off and we sat and we had our feast that Manny offered us and the bananas, and we continued on our way. And then as we were walking, we came across, there was a guy who had just pulled his truck over to the side of the road and was waiting on us and started talking with us. And his name was Liam, which I thought was interesting. Lump or Liam. And he asked a few questions. He offered us some drinks, and we were just about to sit down and have our drinks. And this old guy pulls up in this truck and asks if we're going to this monastery that's nearby. And he was the third person that asked us about this monastery. And so Tom Hamiko and I were like, I guess we should go to this monastery. Everybody keeps asking us about it. And so we said, sure. So we jump in the truck with this guy. His name was Jack. He was, I think, is around 75. And he thought he knew where the monastery was. And so we get to drive in, and we make, we're just heading up and up and up. And the elevation increased so much at one point, so, oh, my, I felt my ears pop. And so we're way, way off the riverbed at this point. And he makes a few wrong turns. And he was 75, so I don't know if he knew how to use like Google Maps or something, but he thought he knew how to get there. And so I think it probably took maybe an hour and a half before we found the place. And I'm not going to go into too many details about this, but so we didn't end up going into the monastery. It looked more like a fortress. It had sort of a 10-foot gate with razor wire across the top. So we thought, maybe they don't like guests. So we didn't knock. So Jack sort of, okay, well, you guys can come back to my place. I'll take you and you can stay at my house for the night. And he thought he knew how to get back to his place, but he'd make a wrong turn. And, you know, the elevation was so high, we were kind of, you know, on the top of these ridges. So if you miss a turn, it's not like there's going to be another block a little ways later. And so he thought maybe he missed the turn, and Ton Hamaka was kind of gently said, maybe we should turn back. And he says, I don't turn back, I only go forward. Cut to 4.5 hours later. 4.5 hours later, we ended up all the way back at Santa Rosa and then got back on River Road and ended up driving the whole route we'd already walked the previous 3 days with this guy named Jack. We did a whole loop, 4.5 hours, and then we got... he called his wife, who was not happy that he'd taken 4.5 hours to get back, and... We could hear it in the tone of her voice. She was not happy. And so he seemed like he was trying to get it out fast. And he was like, yeah, we kind of been on an adventure. I got lost. But anyway, I'm going to bring the monks home with me. And she said, no, very aggressively, no. And so he's like, okay, goodbye. And he just sort of hung up on her. And so he said, I'll just drop you guys off. So after 4.5 hours later, he dropped us off 1.5 miles from where he picked us up. So it was a 4.5 hour drive to go 1.5 miles down the road. But, you know, we bonded with Jack. He told us all about his life. And so it was quite an adventure. And he dropped us off, and Ton Hamaka and I chanted him a blessing. And I kind of turned to Ton Hamaka after he drove off. I said, maybe we shouldn't accept every ride that people offer. And I started to say, you know, unless something sort of incredible, and I don't even get happens out, and this lady stops and says, are you two doing okay? Do you need any help? And so we chatted with her a bit, and she was just checking on us. And so we told her, we're just trying to find a place to stealth camp. And she said, okay, well, you know, anyway, thanks. And she left. And so we don't walk 20, 30 yards from that interaction, and a car pulls up and stops in the road. Anybody have a guess who it is? Manny, that's right. Manny pulls up. He says, hey, guys. We're like, Manny, what's going on? And he kind of puts his hand on his chin like this, and he says, let me pull around and park. And we said, okay. And Ton Hamaka kind of looks at me, and we're like, wow, this is pretty incredible. And so Manny pulls around and parks, and he said, what are you guys doing? And we said, oh, you know, we kind of stealth camp when we're on these walking pilgrimages. And he says, okay. And so I'm thinking, oh, man, he's going to put us up. You know, he's going to at least let us camp in his yard, you know, which happens sometimes. And he says, okay. He said, man, I'd love to help you guys out, but I'm homeless. I live in this van. And I thought, wow, this is the guy that came back and offered us alms 3 times. And he's homeless and he lives in his van. And it was, you know, I'm sort of having that interaction with him at that time. And so, you know, I didn't sort of really consider about how profound that was, how generous this man was who's living in his car. And, you know, so I said, well, yeah, we're just looking to stealth camp. And so he gives us some suggestions about where to stealth camp. And I sort of got the impression that, you know, there are a lot of homeless people, and there's people that are also stealth camping in the area or staying in their cars. And so he sort of gave us some guidance, and he turned to us, and he says, do you guys have a weapon? And we kind of said, no, we don't have a weapon. And he said, do you want one? And we said, no. You've offered us so much, Manny. A weapon is unnecessary. Thank you. No, I didn't. But yeah, we politely declined. And it was out of sort of care and concern for us. And I said, Manny, our weapon is goodness. And he said, oh, wow, that's real faith. I said, yes. And... so, oh, also, you know, he'd mentioned when he was offering us alms, you know, he'd mentioned a couple times, the world is so dark. And then he said it again when he was sort of checking on us. He was like, oh, yeah, the world's so dark. And clearly, you know, there is a lot of darkness, I think, probably in his world, especially when he's asking us if we have a weapon to protect ourselves. He thought that might be necessary. But I said, yeah, but Manny, look at the light you brought into the world. through your goodness. And I think it's such a good reflection, that experience with Manny. And he spoke so much about the darkness in the world, and clearly he's in a very difficult place, but he was engaging in acts of lightness, acts of goodness. And for me, just that thought of no matter what circumstance we find ourselves in, the opportunity is always there to create light, acts of goodness, to cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. It costs nothing to maintain the moral precepts. It costs nothing to train your mind. It costs nothing to develop wisdom so that we can really see clearly the difference between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. That's always available to us no matter where we find ourselves, no matter how dark it gets, that's always there. The light can be found in ourselves. And Manny was a wonderful example of that. And even thinking about him now and sharing the story with you all, it brightens my mind. I hope it brightens yours. And that's a gift from Manny. And so I hope he's doing well. And I hope he reflects on the goodness that he's done and it brightens his mind and he continues to head towards to goodness and brightness. I'll offer that for reflection.
Anagarika Andrew Benin.
So, Lavarna Day, very happy to see you all here. I'm about 5 months into my career as an Anagarika, so I don't know if I'm qualified to speak to a room full of fellow Dhamma farers, but powers that be have decided that this is the way it's going to happen, so here we go. Bear with me. I spent a few days trying to decide what I would speak about this evening, and I had a few topics come up. I thought maybe I'd tell a random story from my past, or wasn't quite sure where to go with it, but considered talking about something about the Dhamma, but obviously being very junior in my monastic career, figured that might be left to the folks more senior than me. So kind of turned it over in my brain a few times, eventually settled on a topic that I thought I could talk about in a knowledgeable, professional way, something that is very near and dear to my heart, and something that I consider myself to have a lot of expertise in, and that, of course, is the arena of, or what you might call the noble art of, kitchen managing. So I figured I would take this very valuable opportunity to give a PSA, a public service announcement, about a behavior that I see sometimes that I would like to tighten up around the margins. I think some of you do this well and have got this down pat, but some of you don't, so I just wanted to put it out there. I figured I could print it all on a sign, but most of the signs get ignored, so just going to take up the next 4 minutes, 3 minutes of your life with this idea. So I'll start out by explaining it, just by giving you a scenario. So say you're going through the food line, maybe it's breakfast, maybe it's the main meal, and you're going down the line and you're filling your bowl with your food, and then you get to a particular item. I'm just going to use the example of Cheez-Its. So say that you really, really, really like Cheez-Its. They're your favorite snack food on earth. Come up to the Cheez-Its, feel a heart skip a beat because you know that there's a few left and you want to take them. So you reach for the tongs and then you go, wait a minute, I really like Cheez-Its, but what if the person behind me likes Cheez-Its too? Maybe I should not take the Cheez-Its so that they can have the Cheez-Its. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. All right, so you skip the Cheez-Its, but problem arises if the person behind you does the same thing, and then the person behind them does the same thing, and then before you know it, everyone's gone through the line and no one takes the Cheez-Its. Now, let's say there's 5 Cheez-Its left. When we're doing the meal cleanup and there's only 5, it's a very tricky situation. What do you do when there's only 5 Cheez-Its? You don't want to throw them away, but you don't really, you can't put out 5 Cheez-Its, right? I mean, that's just not doable. So It's a very tricky situation to be in. Most of the time they just get thrown back into the fridge and there's five Cheez-Its. Just kind of sit there, and as Linda refers to them, as dribs and drabs, just little pieces here and there, little scraps, kind of tend to pile up over time. And then the snack and sweet shelf in the refrigerator fills up with junk, and then eventually they get tossed out because they will never see the light of day, as we know. There's actually a term that I came up with to describe this phenomenon. I call it the paradox of small quantities. And someday if it gets published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, it'll have more colorful technical language than what I'm about to give you. But to paraphrase, the paradox of small quantities essentially states that as the quantity of food in an item decreases, the likelihood that the food will get taken also decreases. So I would encourage each and every one of you, as you go through the food line, whether it's at breakfast or the main meal, if you see an item, especially something that is a low quantity, you can be an all-American hero and just go ahead and pop that whole thing right into your bowl and finish it off and make the cleanup that much easier for the Anagarkas. It would be very much appreciated. So I'll just leave you with this nugget of wisdom. My time is up. So just remember, do the Sangha a solid. Don't fall prey to the paradox. All right, that's it.
Okay, sadhu. Next talk. Random. Anagarika Andreas.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening. It's 9:22 p.m. I hope you guys are not too tired. I won't bore you guys out too much. It's been a month and a half for me as an Anagarika, and I've just learned so much, and I'd just love to share that with you guys. And if you guys find that helpful, it's good. And if not, you can just forget about it. Yeah, so I think just being here, the conditions are just right to where you get to see how things are, which just from my observation, I just see how everything's always changing. And the problem I had was that I didn't see that the practice is also changing. So I always tried to just solidify a practice and just feel safe and secure and, you know, just stick to that and, you know, that's it. But it just, yeah, I just reached a dead end. It just didn't work. And I kind of changed my view to a more dynamic one, more aligned to Dhammo. Yeah, so the practice is always changing. You got to be versatile. Yeah, even like every day and even within a day, depending how things are. Yeah, that I'd say that's like the most fascinating thing I've learned being here. And it's as a byproduct, it's reduced so much suffering, a great amount. Yeah, and also I also learned that related to what I'm talking about is like how I had like fixed views of things, like besides trying to like have like a solid, unchangeable practice, I was also trying to like understand Buddhist terms in that same type of way. The example being like samatha and vipassana. I was like so fixated on trying to like pinpoint what it was. And that's just such a Western thing to do, just like trying to like, yeah, no. And the moment I realized what I was doing is like, oh, now it makes sense. Now I get what it is. And the same thing, so much like kind of suffering just was reduced. And yeah, I hope that kind of like continues, just seeing my erroneous views and changing them to a more accurate view of the way things are. I think that it's helped me, and it'll probably help everyone here, be a service to the world. And how long has it been? I feel like I've said so much already. Dang. Have I expounded too much? All right. Oh, maybe like one more thing. Three, you know, you got to do three, right? So let's see. You know, just chill out. I mean, no, for me, not for you guys, unless that's what you need. Then that's right teaching. But no, for me, you know, I always go through this like cycle of like realizations, like, I just need to chill out. It's not that serious. Just, you know, follow the schedule, be normal. And that's so true, because the whole thing we're aiming towards is something that is like, just is. It's just how things are. So like, it's not complicated. It's simple. And it's, yeah, it just, you know, was it apparent here and now? So I always remind myself that. Hopefully you guys are not like me and you don't need to realize that every day or so. But yeah, just keep it chill. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Dude.
Okay. Truly random. There's only a few left. Anagarika Theo.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhamman sangam namasami. Well, my heart is beating really fast, and my palms are really, really sweaty, and presently there are hindrances just banging around inside of me, so I'm going to give it our best shot. I remember the first time seeing one of these Purna days a long time ago. Venerable Rakito was Gary on that day, and Ajahn Siri was here, and I thought, whoa. So this is just a crazy night, just being on that side of the room. And I thought, I don't know if I want to be on the other side of that room. And then my second Purna day, I remember seeing Anagarika, well, I guess Venerable Jyoti Manto and Venerable Damawaro. And I was like, I wish I was on that side of the room. But, you know, it takes a while to get where you're going. The first time I ever really took a long stay at the monastery, I was on the run. And I was kind of just coming back from saying goodbye to my mother, having her die in my arms and panic attacking my way across the country. And I remember I couldn't drive more than a couple hours without feeling overwhelmed and having to stop on the side of the road and just not really knowing what to do. And I just had this idea in my head that I was going to go and travel and go and try to see all the birds that I possibly could, but I couldn't make it more than a couple hours without just feeling like my heart was going to explode and that I was choking to death and like just racked with just like so much like pain and just like so much intense like sensation. And I remember making it to the monastery and it just all kind of like settled down. And first day was good. Second day was good. I hung out with Debbie and got to speak with some of the monks and just kind of like settled in a little bit more and then just felt better and better and better. And then on the ninth day before I was to leave to go on this kind of like not sure birding adventure, no clue what I was really going to do, these forest fires came and we all evacuated from the monastery. And I started to follow and spend time with the monks. And I remember seeing Venerable Tisaro and just being so impressed with the way he carried himself and just like backlaid with these like dark ashen skies. It was just like black skies and just like ash falling. And I just remember seeing Venerable Tisaro and being like, wow, that was, he just like impressed me so much that day. and Ajahn Sirí and Ajahn Sekh, and it was so powerful just to see these monks just like move from place to place and just like having this home, this monastery that was just like the most beautiful place I ever could have conceived of, but like seeing them carry this like sense of the Dhamma and the sense of home on the street in Willits, and then you know, out at Three Jewels, and then just also seeing the generosity of CTTB and, you know, just taking us in, and then seeing the monks just brighten this cloister. I remember just like, you know, Ajahn Sirí just like sweeping, you know, all the time, and the monks sweeping all the time. And, you know, we went to CTTB and we got given this place, and it was just like covered in cobwebs and age. And it just like had this really intense feeling about it. And I just remember watching the monks, they just did their morning chore, same as they did here. They just started sweeping, started raking. And then pretty soon, like this beautiful cloister that, you know, was so weird and freaky before just emerged. And it's just, I don't know, I was just blown away. And I remember, you know, shortly after that, I asked Lumpa to stay. And he said, you know, what Lumpa always says is, you know, well, stick around, you know. And so I did. But there was this urge inside of me to just keep moving, you know, and it wasn't there yet. It wasn't settled. And there's this feeling of wanting to be with birds. And it's very confusing and racked by this, like, this hindrance of doubt and fear of what if I'm, like, missing out? You know, what if I'm missing out? And so I was halfway in and halfway out. And, you know, after my first winter retreat, I got away and came back. And, you know, we had this big, massive event with all these Kuba Ajahns, and Lumpa Liam was here, Lumpa Jundi, Lumpa Viradamo, and I got to be like Lumpa Liam's personal driver. You know, it was crazy, crazy stuff. And, you know, Lumpa Pasno asked me to stay another year. So, you know, I stayed another year, but I still had to go. And I remember hearing the geese from my kuti migrating, and there was something inside of me that's just like, oh my God, I got to go. And, you know, I just got to go. And so I didn't really realize at the time that, like, the benefit that I was getting here, that my panic attacks had just gone away. My fear, like my restlessness was still, my restlessness was there, but like the fear and like the pain and all that suffering I had carried since, you know, saying goodbye to my mom was just like, it was just gone. You know, it was gone. But, you know, so was I. And I went and I traveled, and then a pandemic happened, and somewhere in the back of my mind, I was like, wow, you know, Dhammawaro, like, really, he did that one right. You know, he planned that out perfectly. And, you know, I got stuck in Costa Rica, which was, you know, that was fine as well. But, you know, and then went and got a master's degree and, you know, had girlfriends and saw all these birds. And I was just like, oh, you know, I'm doing this thing. And then slowly but surely, like, all these kind of like panic attacks and this like intensity started to reemerge. And like all these things I dreamed about when I was in the monastery, you know, just like the places I'd go, the birds I'd see, you know, I don't know, they stopped mattering as much. And I was gaining a lot of fame as a photographer, a bird photographer, and, you know, had this new master's degree and all this debt. And I was just like, just not happy. And I remember about 3 years ago, I just had this feeling like my life was over and that there's nothing left to do. It was just like sitting in the background, just sitting there. And I would just sit there on my phone or, you know, watching YouTube or whatever it was, just felt like I was in a waiting room. It always felt like I was in a waiting room, just like waiting to die. That was like the sense I had about my life, just waiting to die. And, you know, I go to work, I was a teacher at the time, and my kids would be like, oh, you know, so excited. And I'd be able to do my job very well. And my colleagues would be like, oh, you're such a great teacher. You're such a great teacher, you know, giving me these compliments. And then I go home and I just feel like I was waiting to die. And then, I remember Ajahn Nisibo called me up and he was like, inviting me to come drive him and Ajahn Jayasaro. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. You know, then I don't know if I'm going to do that. And Ajahn Nisibo just has a way. And so I end up, you know, driving 3 hours down and, spending time with Ajahn Jayasaro and just like watching as he gave this Dhamma talk to all these lay people in this crazy huge monastery that, him and Ajahn Nisibo were on one side and then the lay folks were on the other. And I was in the back of the room and I was like, man, I just really want to be on that other side. Like, I want to be on the side that the monks are sitting on. There's something inside of me that just like felt that. And then the next day I drove with Ajahn Jayasar. Sorry if I'm going long right now. And we sat, or we rode together for 4 hours. And then he offered all of basically the dana that he had gotten that night to my kids, my students. And they had this massive like ice cream party, and they had this like this huge thing that was donated by the monks. They didn't even know what monks were. And their only response to this whole entire thing was that you should become a monk. They really wanted me to become a monk. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's like, you just get given ice cream and, you know, mini golf and all this money. And he's like, you should be a monk. And so the next summer I came back to the monastery, and just like, I realized that if I was going to die right then and there, that I would only have one regret. And that's that I never got to wear the robes, and I never got to receive alms. I never got to go on Pindapat, and I never got to just feel what it would be like to be part of this like field of merit. And at that point in time, like, education didn't mean anything to me. My photography didn't mean anything to me. Birds didn't mean anything to me. Like, it just wasn't anything there, but I still had this faith in the Dhamma. Like, it still was there. And so then at the end of my visit, I asked Tanajan if I could come back. And he said, you know, well, let's see what happens. Sure, maybe in a year. And then I won't bore you all with the details, but a series of pretty miraculous and crazy things happened in order for me to pay off $70,000 of debt in 1 year. And I made it back. And I was invited back to this community. And I just feel so much gratitude to this family and this place. And my friend came to visit me a couple weeks ago. And he said to me that, that you, like, this is your home. And I truly feel that. I feel like Abhayagiri is my home, and that these are my brothers, and this is my family. And it just is such a gift to be part of this experience, part of this Dhamma, and being a faith type. That's like what I run on. That's what I go on. And so I hope you all get this experience as well, where you just like get to have a home and all this like madness and all like this suffering, and get to like just build and cultivate a little bit of faith, and get to feel like a little bit of peace and all this like intense like madness, the storm of what it is, tiny little life. And that right now, if I died, I keep saying this all the time, I think I'd just be totally, totally fine with it. I think I'd be totally happy with it right now in this moment. I'd be happy to die. So I hope you all feel the same. Yeah, I do.
Well, should we take a break before that? No, okay, just power through the final one. Last but not least, Samanera Gunakuro.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Well, here we are, the last slot of the evening. So it's been a really enjoyable night for me. I think this is the third one of these that I've been here for, and probably my favorite of the three. Nothing against any of the speakers at the other ones, just it's felt like a particularly lively and engaging night. That said, I have some pretty distinct memories of around this time, a couple years ago, feeling like my knees hurt and I was tired, and really hoping that whoever was up last would be quick. So I'll try and do my part not to make this go on too long in case anyone is experiencing similar feelings. It's interesting because there's always, you know, ideas of things that I could talk about on these that kind of float around, and they crop up and disappear some throughout the night. And then, of course, you're at the end and it doesn't really matter anyways. So there's a brief sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya that I've been thinking about a lot recently has really stuck with me. And I'm going to paraphrase pretty heavily because I don't have it memorized. But it's something along the lines of the duty of a farmer is to plow his fields and
plant his crops and irrigate them. And the farmer doesn't have any special abilities, psychic powers to say, grow tomorrow, ripen the day after, bear fruit the day after that. And the same is true with us. It's our duty to cultivate, train in higher ethics and higher wisdom and higher mind. And none of us have the ability to go, may my mind be freed today. May my mind be freed tomorrow. May my mind be freed after that. But there does come a time with the changing of the seasons where the farmer's crops ripen and they grow and they bear fruit. And the same is true with us. If we train, if we cultivate, if we work towards ethics and wisdom and mindfulness, then maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not the next day, but someday it will bear fruit and it will lead to freedom. And I just think there's something really important in that idea as I go about my daily life here. Just that reminder, it's maybe the patience side of patient endurance. We talk a lot about the endurance side, or at least that's a lot of what I think about, but it's just the patient side of putting in the effort to pay attention to what it is that I'm doing and why I'm doing it, and really try to create something wholesome, and to know that while it may not always feel like it pays off spectacularly today, that it does have benefits. And oftentimes I can look back and I can see that I'm in a different place today than I was 3 years ago or 5 years ago or, God forbid, 10 years ago. And there's something really wonderful there. So I think the final thing that I'll say is there's a reflection that we chant, which is, my very life is sustained through the gifts of others. This should be reflected upon again and again. And so this is just my opportunity and chance to express appreciation for all of the people here, monastic and lay, and the people listening, and the people not here, and the people not listening, and the people on Alms Round who dedicate and give so much support financially, or with their time, with their energy, with their effort, coordinating and making all of this possible so that I have the ability to be here and train and practice, and so that all of the anyone who wants to has the ability to come and stay here in whatever form that is, monastic or lay. And so I appreciate that, and thank you, and thanks for being here tonight, and I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Namaya Dhammakataya Sadhu Karangadamase Sadhu.